Funding for Think comes from SMU Master and Doctor of Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. After years of headlines, public service campaigns, and diet industry marketing efforts, America has finally gotten the message. Being fat is bad, right? The percentage of us who are overweight and obese rose steadily during the latter half of the 20th century, and the most dire predictions warn that by 2030, close to 50% of us will have body mass indexes above the normal range. The concern is that those extra pounds put millions of us at risk for diabetes, heart disease, and early death unless we lose weight. But as my guest has discovered by looking more closely at the research, the story of how weight affects health in general and mortality rates in particular is a lot more complicated than we have been led to believe, in part because losing weight after being fat is not the same as being slim for a lifetime. Harriet Brown is Associate Professor of Magazine Journalism at the S.I. Newhouse School of Public Communications at Syracuse University. Her new book is called Body of Truth: How Science, History, and Culture Drive Our Obsession with Weight and What We Can Do About It. Harriet, welcome back to Think.
Thanks for having me again.
So you open the book with a story of yourself sitting with your therapist being really upset with your current weight, and she said this radical thing to you.
Yes. She said, "What if you were okay with your body the way it is right now?" And for me, it was as if she had said, what if I told you the world was flat and you might just want to step off the edge of it?" I mean, it was like an appalling thing to say. And like my reaction was immediate. You're nuts. You know, no way. I'm not okay the way I am. I'm not going to give up. I'm not going to let myself go. You know, I'm not going to be a statistic. I'm going to keep fighting the good fight. That was my immediate reaction. And being a very wise therapist, she just kind of let me think about it for a while. And, you know, I dismissed her words, but I couldn't forget them. They kept coming back to me and back to me. And for me, that was the beginning of a process of shifting the paradigm in thinking about weight and health and appearance, too. And it was a very liberating experience for me.
You write that the definitions of overweight and obesity, like the medical clinical definitions, have changed over time. So a BMI that was considered normal before 1998 might have moved over into the overweight category literally overnight, meaning lots of people were added to the ranks of the overweight without gaining an ounce.
That's right. And before 1998, the BMI chart, which is a whole different, you know, we'll talk about that, I'm sure. But, you know, there were two categories, basically. You were in the, well, three. There was underweight, there was the normal category, and then there was overweight. And then in 1998, scientists decided for a variety of reasons, many of which, according to my research, were fairly arbitrary. They decided to revamp the BMI chart, partly so that people could remember the categories more easily. And they created, you know, underweight, normal, overweight, obese. And all of the thresholds got lower in terms of being considered overweight and obese. So now you're considered normal if your BMI is between 18.5 and 24.9, whereas before you had a couple more BMI points and you were still in the normal range. And what's crazy about that is that, well, for one thing, there was no real scientific reason to make those changes. And for another thing, if you look at how the actual statistics line up in terms of mortality and health, you know, a big chunk of the healthiest, quote, place for us to be is now considered overweight.
Between 25 and 27 BMI.
Yeah, or even 25 and 30. Mm-hmm. And 30 is over 30, you're considered obese. And then over 40, you're considered severely obese. Some people say morbidly obese. So, but, you know, a lot of the research that I have found shows that, you know, mortality rates are lowest in that sort of overweight to mildly obese part of the chart. They're certainly lower than they are for people in the underweight and normal parts of the chart. So it's very perplexing to me.
So a lot of people know BMI stands for body mass index, and roughly speaking, it takes into account your height and your weight and spits out this number at you. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. It's a very blunt measure. It's really just a ratio of height and weight, and some of the critiques of BMI are that it doesn't take anything else into account. So it doesn't take into account how much muscle mass you have, for example. So athletes often have high BMIs and would often be classified as obese if you just went strictly by the chart. People who are short often have higher BMIs simply because the ratio is, you know, skewed. And it doesn't take into account how much lean muscle mass you have, where your adipose tissue is. You know, do you have more fat around your waist where it's more dangerous, or in other places where it's benign? So it's kind of a crude measure, and it's become, you know, the be-all, end-all for us. We always talk about weight and health now in terms of BMI.
How did BMI come into existence as the thing we used, rather than just saying, you know, if you're over 100 pounds, you're this, if you're over 200 pounds, you're that? How did BMI become the standard?
That is a good question. We can blame it on a researcher named Ansel Keys, who actually did a lot of great research over the course of his career on weight and health. But, you know, he even said, you know, BMI is not a good measure for talking about individual people's health. It's a good measure for looking at populations, sort of large scale. But his work sort of began the process of scientists using it. And I think in part because it's really easy and it's non-invasive. You know, you don't have to pinch people with calipers. You can also use it retroactively. So you can look at studies that were done earlier where you know people's, or where their height and weight were recorded, and you can make, you can extract data from that. You can say, okay, well, we can also come up with these weight categories for them. So, you know, people like it, and I think a lot of the people who's, I think most people agree that it's not the most precise measure, but many in the field still think it's good enough.
How much heavier are we today overall, Harriet, than we were in 1960?
Well, the average weight gain that happened for Americans happened between 1980 and 2000. And if you sort of average out across all people in the country, you come up with a figure of about 20 pounds, 18 to 20 pounds heavier per person. But it didn't exactly, you know, tumble out that way. Many people got a little heavier, and a few people got a lot heavier. So there was a disproportionate increase in the number of people on the very extreme end of the obesity scale, and a sort of, you know, relatively mild but still statistically significant rise in the weight of, you know, sort of the average person in this country. But that rise pretty much stopped in 2000. So, you know, it's not continuing to go up and up. In fact, within a few demographics, it's starting to go down a little bit. And we don't really know exactly why it went up during that time. That's one of the most interesting things. I mean, we talk about it a lot. We talk about the obesity epidemic. There's a lot of words that we use to talk about that, and it's always couched in this, you know, crisis sort of language. And we must do something right now to stop it, or else it will, you know, we'll all be obese. And I find that interesting because the data really doesn't support that at all. We had this rise. There are some interesting theories about why our collective weight went up, but pretty much it seems to have plateaued for now.
Are we also taller than we used to be?
Yeah, we're about an inch taller on average, which we never talk about.
So what about insurance actuarial tables? How did those get mixed into this measurement of, you know, the danger or relative safety of being a particular weight?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question because, I mean, if you think about it, where did this whole idea come from that, you know, we have to, like, get down to, like, you know, very minute measures of whether people are, you know, where they fall on a chart? And as you say, it's kind of started with Metropolitan Life Insurance Company. And they, of course, wanted to come up with some numbers to predict, you know, when people died, basically, so they could price their policies accordingly. And so they took data from about 5 million of their policyholders and sort of crunched that and came up with this chart. What's interesting, though, is that they only, you know, it was sort of a selective chunk of data. They only took data from people who bought policies from them. So, you know, if you think about that, there's probably some skewing in who signed up for policies and, you know, who didn't and what kind of people they were and what their health conditions might have been. But those early charts were actually, you know, allowed for sort of heavier weights, and they were just height to weight. You know, if you remember, if you ever went to Weight Watchers like in the 1970s, as I did, you know, those were the charts that were typically used to set target weights, and they were done by height. So that was kind of the first level of let's find a way to standardize what everybody should weigh according to height, which is really interesting because, you know, people, as we all know, people don't all come in the same sorts of shapes and bone densities. And, you know, I have friends who are exactly my height, and we might be 50 pounds apart, you know, and we both might feel great and be healthy at those weights. So different bodies, you know, have different requirements, really.
Clearly, the food we eat and the amount of exercise we get, the ratio of calories taken in to calories burned, that has an effect on how much we weigh. But how much do our genes have to do with that sort of set point that our bodies like to weigh?
A lot more than we like to think. You know, there's a sort of expression, if you really want to be thin, choose, you know, two thin parents and ideally four thin grandparents. And so, you know, genetics definitely plays a role. And certainly the food we eat and the physical activity that we engage in and the kind of food we eat and our environment, everything plays a role. But, you know, we know, you know, one of the things you hear often when people talk about weight and weight loss is, you know, calories in, calories out. And that sort of implies that every body processes calories in the same way, and that if you want to lose weight, you just have to create like a calorie deficit, which is true. You have to spend more calories than you take in. But not all bodies, we know that not all bodies use calories in the same way. For instance, people who lose weight and regain it, you know, what we might call weight cycling or yo-yo dieting, their bodies become a lot more efficient. So that's, you know, you might wind up with someone who's considered obese, but who eats, you know, 1,200 calories a day and doesn't lose weight because their body, their metabolism has been messed up basically by the constant dieting and regaining.
And that metabolism shift lasts forever once it's happened?
It does. You know, our bodies are sort of designed to, they're designed to protect against starvation, really. And so, you know, once they learn to hang on to calories, they really don't like to let go of those calories, or that once adipose tissue is created, it really doesn't disappear.
So what's different about the people who do lose significant amounts of weight? And I know it's a small percentage, but some do keep it off for years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they do. And I've talked to quite a few of them over the last decade or so, and they have a number of things in common, but the main one is they basically make it their top priority. It's, as more than one person has said to me, it's not a lifestyle, it's a job. It's, you know, what they think about constantly, all day, every day. Their lives are arranged around that. They endure physical, you know, fitness regimens that would seem pretty punishing to a lot of us or unsustainable, and they eat pretty minimally. And, you know, I'm not knocking that. If that's what you want to do, that's what you want to do, and that's cool, but that's kind of what it takes.
My guest is Harriet Brown. She's Associate Professor of Magazine Journalism at the S.I. Newhouse School of Public Communications at Syracuse University and author of Body of Truth, How Science, History, and Culture Drive Our Obsession with Weight and What We Can Do About It. We'll come back to the conversation in 2 minutes. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies, offering evening programs for a Master of Liberal Studies and the new Doctor of Liberal Studies degree. You can design your own master's or doctoral degree at SMU this fall. More at smu.edu/GLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Harriet Brown, a communications journalism professor at the School of Public Communications at Syracuse University and author of a new book called Body of Truth, How Science, History, and Culture Drive Our Obsession with Weight and What We Can Do About It. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think at kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. Okay, so Harriet, you mentioned in the last segment that people with BMIs between 25 and 30 in a given year as a population have the lowest mortality rates compared with those who are underweight or severely obese. Is it possible, though, that those individuals are living long lives, but they are disabled early on by like joint problems and diabetes and high blood pressure, that sort of thing?
Well, that's certainly the assumption. So, you know, that's sort of the first line. People say, well, you know, we're all going to die sooner. Our children are going to have shorter lives than us because they're heavier. And, you know, once you sort of methodically disprove that, then that becomes the next thing. Well, but they're going to be sicker. And, you know, what's the point of living longer if you're, as you say, disabled by all these diseases? So so there's an assumption. There's a correlations. Some are weaker. Some are stronger between BMI and disease. The strongest one is between BMI and type 2 diabetes. And our assumptions about those are that being fatter causes these diseases. And what's interesting about that is that, well, there's a couple things that are interesting. And one is that, as scientists do like to say, correlation does not imply causation. So just because there are higher levels of type 2 diabetes among people with higher BMIs, although it's still a pretty weak correlation. Just for a little context, if you look at, say, lung cancer and smoking, the correlation there is like a power of 9 or 10, right? So if you smoke, your chance of developing lung cancer is increased by a risk factor of 9 or 10. With, say, severe obesity and type 2 diabetes, that is between 1 and 2. But still, it is there. But what we don't know is which comes first, the chicken or the egg. So there are researchers, including a doctor named Peter Attia, who's done some very convincing work on this, to suggest that maybe instead of fat causing diabetes, maybe weight gain is an early symptom of type 2 diabetes. Basically, metabolism is so complicated, we don't really understand all the mechanisms that are happening. So that's sort of one thing. There are these correlations. They may or may not hold true, and they may be stronger or weaker. So that's one thing. And there's also another variable that's rarely taken into account, especially when you look at big population studies and you sort of look at like how many people, what percentage of people get heart disease and, you know, what were their BMIs. Rarely do those studies look at fitness levels. And so there are a number of researchers, including Stephen Blair and Paul McCauley, who've done a lot of work on sort of teasing out this level of fitness. And they believe very strongly that, you know, it's less about what you weigh and more about your fitness level. So it's we've heard about this in the news a bit, you know, fat but fit versus, you know, thin and unfit. We don't really have the answers now, but it's very clear that there's not this sort of direct linear relationship between, well, if you get fat, you know, you're definitely coming down with these diseases or you're much, much, much more likely to do that. And finally, another interesting aspect of this conversation is in what researchers call the obesity paradox. And that is the fact that for some diseases, and it's those same diseases that we associate with obesity, right? So type 2 diabetes, heart disease, some kidney disease, you know, heart failure. If you are heavier and you are diagnosed with one of those chronic diseases, you tend to live longer and do better than someone who's thinner when they are diagnosed with those diseases. Now, we don't know why that is, and there are a number of theories. You know, maybe thinner people get like a much more severe version of those diseases. Maybe heavier people get more aggressive treatment because they're heavier and doctors think they're at higher risk. Or maybe there's some other explanation that we still don't know. Or maybe fat takes on a protective it has a protective quality in some situations. You know, the jury's still out. But I think if you look at all of those things together, you kind of can't really support anymore the idea that, well, being fat causes all these diseases and therefore, you know, we're going to live longer, but we're going to be pretty miserable while we're doing it.
One thing you did learn is that whether we can definitively prove that fat causes these diseases, a lot of doctors and medical professionals seem to be biased against their fatter patients.
Yes, they do. There's a very strong, robust body of research on stigma and weight that's coming out of Yale, a lot of it being done by Rebecca Poole at the Rudd Center for Obesity and Food Policy. She's been looking at this for about the last 15 years. And, you know, in a number of her studies, she's looked at attitudes among medical professionals toward fat people. And, you know, as she told me once, you know, if I was looking at biases around different, you know, like around race or gender, I'd kind of have to, you know, couch my questions in a certain way because, you know, people don't feel comfortable coming out with those kinds of stigmatizing statements. But she said, when it comes to weight, man, they just don't, you know, they just come right out with it. There's not a filter. There's not a sense that, well, maybe this is a little problematic. And I think she found something like almost 3/4 of doctors, you know, admitted to strong bias against their fat patients. They used words like lazy, unattractive, non-compliant, stupid to describe their fat patients. And, you know, it's an important thing because it's not only like you want to go to your doctor and feel like your doctor isn't judging you, but you also, the non-compliant piece of it is important because if your doctor thinks you're not going to follow through on treatment he or she recommends, then that might lead them to prescribe and treat differently. So that is a big problem.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Judy in Dallas. Hi, Judy.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
Great. I'm calling to ask Professor Brown if he has any information or if she knows of any new studies that might target how blood type addresses how you process food and helpfully work with weight gain and metabolism.
I can't say that I am aware of any of those. No, sorry.
What did you learn about the influence of the diet industry on the way weight is perceived in the United States?
It's got a whopping big influence, $61 billion a year worth
wow.
of influence. There's a lot of money at stake here. And as we know, when there's a lot of money at stake, people, you know, people get protective. And I think it's driving a lot of things, including, you know, it's driving research and studies. So there's a lot of literature on how research can be skewed by, you know, interested parties. So I think something like only 30% of the scientific research done in this country is government funded, like by the NIH. The rest is privately funded, and a lot of that is funded by pharmaceutical companies, and you know, which, like, great. It's great that they're funding it, but the problem is they have an agenda, and or they may have an agenda, and if the research doesn't support that agenda, it can be, you know, never published. That's pretty common. Or the findings can be manipulated in such a way that, you know, they say statistics lie, and you can manipulate them to say almost anything you want. So, you know, there's a lot at stake in keeping the status quo. In other words, how we think about weight. We must all be thin or else, you know, the world comes to an end in place.
Many people have heard the advice, Harriet, that overweight people who lose even, say, like 5% of total body weight can significantly cut their risk for things like diabetes and hypertension. Mm-hmm. You discovered that being fat and losing weight is not medically equivalent to having been slender all along.
Right. And so one big takeaway from my research is that health is really a very individual thing. So I want your listeners to know that it's not like I'm saying, you know, no one will ever benefit from losing weight, right? Because there might be people in some situations who might benefit. One of the problems is that we can lose weight in the short term, but most people, as you kind of alluded to earlier, don't keep it off. I think definitely upward of 90% of people who lose like a chunk of weight, like maybe more than 25 pounds, regain it within 3 to 5 years. So, you know, what we end up with is this weight cycling, and we know that that's bad for us. We know that there's a lot of really negative health consequences, including, ironically, obesity, right? So one of the biggest risk factors for obesity later in life is a history of dieting, because dieting resets your metabolism. You know, you need fewer calories, and so you wind up heavier than when you started, which I personally think is one of the explanations for why collectively we gained weight, you know, because there was such an emphasis on dieting in the 70s and 80s. And I think that really propelled a lot of us to like go gung ho and then wind up gaining more weight than ever. And now I forgot the first part of your question.
I forgot the first part of my question, too. We were talking about the effect of, well, anyway, we'll move on and I'll think of it in a moment. Talk a little bit about this. You know, very many people are concerned about children who seem to be heavier today, fatter today than they were a couple of generations ago. There are some real concerns with putting overweight children on a diet. Can you talk about those?
Yeah, there are some real concerns, and the big one is that it doesn't work. You know, that's one of them. I mean, kids who are put on diets early in their lives wind up fatter. So that's one thing. So it's counterproductive. Another thing is that they end up feeling badly about themselves. And some of the most interesting research I looked at suggests that, and doesn't suggest, comes right out and says that, you know, this was a study of almost 10,000 people, so it wasn't like a tiny little self-selected study. People who were unhappy about their weight, and it didn't matter what they weighed, whether they were thin, overweight, or obese, were much more likely to go on to develop type 2 diabetes, for example. So we might be setting kids up for lifelong health problems that they wouldn't have otherwise. And then, you know, that doesn't even take into account the fact that it's really not fun to live a life that's consumed by this, you know, longing to be thin and this kind of inability to get there. It's devastating, really, for a lot of people.
Back to the question a couple of minutes ago. The idea that losing weight after having been fat is not the same as never having been fat in the first place.
Right, right. So that goes back to the fact that, you know, first of all, once you have a certain number of fat cells, they don't go away. They I don't know what the actual term is. They get deflated. You know, they might not be full of fat, but they are still there, and it's easier to be fat. And then we also know that, you know, the biomarkers for health don't work the same way in people who are weight suppressed, as some people say, and people who are, you know, fat or naturally thin. So again, we make all these assumptions that, you know, thin is good, fat is bad, therefore we need to make everyone thin. And even if we could do that, it's pretty clear that that wouldn't be the best strategy.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Greg in Dallas. Hey, Greg.
Hi, Chris. My name is Greg. I'm glad to be talking to you.
Welcome.
I was wondering if your guest could speak a little bit to genetics and metabolism. I'm 25 and significantly overweight. My doctor tells me I'm obese. But I know that I work out more and eat about the same amount of food as my slightly older brother. And he's a pretty skinny guy. I didn't know what's going on there, if your guest had any insight. I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, what a great question. And, you know, in a word, genetics and body type. Even though, you know, your brother and you have the same parents, you might not have the same genetic profile, and you sounds like you don't have the same body type. And so, you know, it's a classic example of how different people use and spend calories in different ways. I would say, you know, one of the big takeaways for me in doing all this research, too, is that our emphasis on weight is sort of not serving us if we were focusing instead on health. So, you know, eating well and getting some physical activity in your life, you know, most days, those are things that are going to improve your health no matter what you weigh. So I would say to you, if you're heavier and you're, you know, healthy and you feel good and you're working out and you're doing, you know, living your life, then that sounds good to me.
How does stigma against people who are overweight affect incentive to exercise?
Not the way we think it does, right? So in this country, there are a number of people who propose, you know, we don't stigmatize fat people enough. And they kind of point to the decline in smoking. And they say, you know, that's because we now stigmatize smokers more. And so fewer people are smoking, which I don't have enough information on to be able to assess that. Although, yes, smoking levels are lower. But it doesn't work that way with weight, for sure. And I think maybe one reason is because you can quit smoking, as difficult as it is. But, you know, we all have to eat. You can't quit eating. So what the findings are that when you feel discriminated against, when you feel stigmatized, when you feel bad about your body, rather than inspire you to healthier behaviors, it actually has the opposite effect. People exercise less, their diets deteriorate, and it kind of makes sense psychologically. You know, when you don't feel good about yourself, you don't feel inspired to take good care of yourself. You know, we kind of get into these self-destructive cycles. And so stigma and discrimination are pretty much bad for us across the board, especially when it comes to weight. One of the interesting correlations with obesity is that it's, you know, heavily correlated with poverty. And so is type 2 diabetes. And so I think there's a lot to be explored there. I mean, if you're poor, poor people definitely have higher levels of type 2 diabetes. Now, stigma, does it play a role? We know that it raises levels of cortisol, which is the stress hormone in your body, you know. Quality of food that's available. There's many, many factors that go into it. But bottom line, it's really not a good healthcare strategy for anyone.
We're speaking this hour with Harriet Brown of Syracuse University. Her new book is called Body of Truth: How Science, History, and Culture Drive Our Obsession with Weight and What We Can Do About It. You can be part of the conversation by emailing think@kera.org. You can find me on Twitter @ChrisBoydThink, or you can call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from the new SMU Doctor of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening doctoral program for Dallas community leaders and professionals. Now accepting applications for fall. More at smu.edu/DLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Harriet Brown, who is Associate Professor of Magazine Journalism at Syracuse University and author of the new book, Body of Truth: How Science, History, and Culture Drive Our Obsession with Weight and What We Can Do About It. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. I couldn't find exactly the page in the book, but someone you spoke to talked about having lost some weight, and so many people commented on it that her takeaway was like, wow, I hadn't realized how important my appearance was to everyone else and how much they didn't like me before.
Yeah, yes. That was a friend of mine who made that comment to me, but I've heard some version of that from pretty much everyone I've talked to who's ever lost some weight. And, you know, this was interesting because my friend is heard me talk about this research for years, and she's not a person who's particularly fixated on weight, but it was so stunning to her, the difference in how people treated her. And I've heard that again and again and again, and I've experienced it myself. You know, when you're thin, you're like a very different person, and of course it makes you think, my God, people must have thought I was hideous before. People do.
Yeah. Is that for some reason a good enough incentive to try to lose weight, that regardless of whether it's right or wrong, society is going to judge you for being perceived as too fat?
Well, I think for some people it is. But, you know, the analogy that I always think of is, you know, if kids on a playground are bullying a kid for, you know, sexual orientation or something, I mean, we wouldn't tell the kid, well, you better change your sexual orientation so right. you don't get bullied, you know, but that seems to be the solution here, right? So if you're fat, you know, and you don't want to get bullied, it's your job to change yourself rather than the rest of the world's job to sort of take a step back and reconsider that bias.
It is interesting also when you meet someone who has recently lost a lot of weight, they're usually the first ones, if they're not stigmatizing other people, they're certainly looking at their old self and jumping on the bandwagon and saying, I was so bad before, I was so gross, I made bad choices, that sort of thing.
Oh, yeah, and I think, you know, that is a prime example of how we have all internalized this idea so deeply. It runs, it's so ingrained in all of us. I mean, it's really hard to even root that out in yourself, even when you know all the facts. So we've been so conditioned to think that, like you said, bad and good, you know, we put this sort of moral overlay on it. You know, fat people are bad in some way. They're lazy. They're self-indulgent. They're, you know, I find it fascinating that this conversation is often couched in extremes. So I've talked to people who are pretty hostile to the idea that, you know, fat could ever be anything but awful. And they always go right to, you know, well, if we're not watching our weight and really, you know, being careful and depriving ourselves, then we're just all sitting on the couch eating bonbons and canceling our gym membership. And it's like, whoa, wait a minute. There's a lot of space in between there. You know, but it's so often we are our own harshest critics. And I think there's something else going on, too, that I think there's this sense of privilege that comes in this culture from being thin. And, you know, it's hard to let go of it. And when we have a sense of privilege, we tend to feel entitled. And we tend to feel like, well, I've earned that, you know. And if you've worked hard to lose weight, if you've deprived yourself, if you've devoted your life to it, I think it's natural that you're going to feel like, well, this is a much better way to be. And I'm going to be hard on everyone who's not that way because, you know, then if you say that it's kind of okay or maybe it's not so terrible to be fat, then wait a minute, what did I just spend all this energy doing and why?
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have Marshall on the line in Dallas. Hi, Marshall.
Hi. I was just wondering if Ms. Brown might know of a study that deals with either of the popular stomach surgeries that are out there available now in relationship to the reduction or control of type 2 diabetes.
Mm-hmm. I think I don't know them like broken down by surgery, and there's not good figures on that because there are so many different kinds of surgery and they're sort of constantly evolving. But I know that a lot of people who go through some form of gastric bypass surgery will see their type 2 diabetes go into remission. But the interesting thing about that is that it happens long before they lose a significant amount of weight. And so when I looked into that, I learned that you also will see type 2 diabetes go into remission if you go on a very, very, very low-calorie eating plan, which, of course, is what happens after you have gastric bypass. You can only eat like a few hundred calories a day, certainly in the beginning. So I think that is what the cause and effect is, that, you know, cutting your intake so drastically will put type 2 diabetes into remission. It comes back for some people. I think even after surgery, it's very difficult to sustain eating such small amounts of food every day. But certainly it seems like it gives remission for a while for some people.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next with Doug in Fort Worth. Hi, Doug.
Oh, hi. How are you?
Great.
Just an observation. I think Ms. Brown is dramatically understating how severe the obesity problem is in the United States today. And if you look at our travel to Europe or to Asia or just about any other country other than maybe just a few, the obesity here is just shocking. And I think the kind of the, you know, from just the sound of the program, it really concerns me that it is being understated and the health issues associated with the obesity are just obviously enormous.
Thanks for your call, Doug. Do you want to respond to that, Harriet?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, to say the health problems are obviously enormous is kind of what we do, right? But the research doesn't actually support that, number one. Number two, I think it's true that we are fatter here in this country than people in a lot of European and Asian countries. And one of the interesting things about that is that, you know, some people suspect, and I'm among them, that one reason why we're fatter is because we put so much emphasis on weight and dieting, and because we have, you know, pushed weight loss so much that we have wound up fatter than we might have if, you know, than say people in France where they eat plenty of, you know, high fat foods that we sort of recoil in horror from, and yet they eat them in smaller amounts. They don't worry about it. They don't have the same level of, you know, energy devoted to it, and they're not as fat. So I think what we have to ask ourselves is, you know, how is this emphasis on weight loss working out for us? And I would contend that it's not working out very well.
You have had pushback from some of the scientists that you've tried to interview who just think that talking about this out loud is going to tell people that it doesn't matter at all what they eat or whether they exercise.
Right. And that's part of that black and white thinking that I find so fascinating, especially coming from scientists who have to process nuance in their research, or, you know, if they're any good, they do. So, you know, I don't understand that, really. I think that in addition to the financial investment that we have, you know, in the weight loss industries for sort of, you know, keeping on this weight loss paradigm, I think there's a sort of emotional and moral investment, too, that a lot of us have made. A lot of careers have been built around this idea of weight loss at any cost. And I think it's just an idea that a lot of people are very attached to. And they don't seem to be able to really process anything in the middle there.
Let's go back to the phones now. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. Joe is on the line in Fort Worth. Hi, Joe.
Hi. Yes. Thanks for having me. Mm-hmm. I had a question. You've been talking a lot about diets here, and when you're referring to diets, I just wondered, are you referring to, you know, going on a very strict diet, like maybe a paleo diet or like juice only diet, or are you talking about, you know, just changing and being an overall more healthy eater in general?
Good question. And what I mean when I say diet is any kind of eating that's meant to produce a calorie deficit. So whether it's paleo or Atkins or, you know, high carb, low carb, or whether you're just like cutting out food groups or whatever it is, if the goal is to lose weight, then that's what I would consider a diet.
Why is it that for so many people who have tried to lose weight, they can get to a certain point and their true weight loss goal may be much lower than what they have sort of plateaued at?
Well, I think it's partly because we have we all have these unrealistic ideals in front of us all the time, right? We all think that if we just, you know, work out a little more and diet more, we could someday look like, you know, I don't know, Cindy Crawford. But, you know, the reality is only about 5% of people have the genetics to ever even get close to looking like that. And then, of course, we're not taking into account how Photoshop and retouching and things like that alter what we see all the time. So we have these ideals in front of us that are literally unattainable, and I think that's part of it. And then the other part of it is just, you know, our bodies have, you can only go so far, you know, unless you are going to tip into an eating disorder and really, you know, develop anorexia or something like that. There's a certain point at which your body will defend, you know, unless you really, really starve yourself. And few of us want to do that or have the ability to do that for any length of time.
The first time you and I talked was a few years ago when you had published your memoir, Brave Girl Eating, about your daughter's mm-hmm. struggles with anorexia. I wonder how dealing with a health crisis like that affects your worldview and your desire to kind of look at this issue from different angles than the ones we are typically fed. Pardon the pun.
You're entitled. It was definitely a big motivator for me, not so much on an intellectual level as an emotional level. One of the things that I found really, really disturbing was while my daughter was sick and in recovery, You know, at moments, many moments when she was emaciated and did not look well and really looked like she was at death's door and was, people would literally, women would literally come up to her in the street and praise her appearance. They would say, "Oh, you're so slender. You have such a great figure." They would ask her for diet tips, and I'd be standing there just like wanting to strangle them. Like, are you kidding me? She does not look well. You know, she could die at any moment. Mm-hmm. What are you talking about? So that really sensitized me to how messed up. I mean, I grew up in this culture, so on some level I never questioned it. But having to see things from a different point of view really gave me the ability and the perspective to ask some questions of myself and other people and think about, what are we doing here? Why is this so important to us?
Did you confront those people who complimented your daughter when she was very, very sick?
I did, some of them. That did not typically go well. but a lot of them who were like acquaintances would just like sort of say, "Oh my gosh, well, I didn't mean anything by it." Hmm. And you know, they didn't. They're not bad people. They're not thinking. They're so steeped in this perspective that they didn't stop to consider. And I hope that some of those conversations made them think about things in a different way. But I guess I don't know.
You also mentioned in the book that, you know, parents are more concerned about their overweight daughters than their overweight sons.
Yeah. If it's one of those handy little Google algorithm things, you know, that they Google, you know, what to do if my daughter is overweight, at like many times more often than they do about their sons. And, you know, look, we live in a culture where women are still judged very heavily on appearance. And, you know, the more political and social and economic power we have, it seems, the more stringent that appearance, those appearance requirements become. So not only do we now have to be smart and, you know, work hard and earn money, we have to do it all while wearing a size 2 and, you know, walking in high heels. And it's a very punitive set of way to think about women. And I think, you know, I mean, as a woman, I kind of want to rise up against that and say, just a cotton picking minute here. You know, that has nothing to do with so much of our lives.
Did you finally achieve what your therapist proposed, which is becoming okay with the body that you have right now?
I would say most of the time. Mm-hmm. I think it's impossible to live in this culture and always feel okay about not looking like, you know, what you think you should look like. But, you know, at the point that I went to that therapist, so much of my energy was consumed with anxiety and despair over my appearance. And I can honestly say now that, you know, I will have an occasional day when it really gets to me, but most of the time I'm focused on other things and much more productively, too.
Harriet Brown is Associate Professor of Magazine Journalism at the S.I. Newhouse School of Public Communications at Syracuse University. Her new book is called Body of Truth: How Science, History, and Culture Drive Our Obsession with Weight and What We Can Do About It. Harriet, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Always a pleasure to talk to you, Chris.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer with help on the phones this hour from Celine Alba. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think and email the show at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.